Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Ethics Experts. If it's your first time joining us, welcome. And if you are a returning subscriber, hello, friend. Hope you're having an amazing day. You see what happens when you subscribe to the Ethics Experts? You get that bonus greeting on every single episode. So hit that subscribe button. I am here today with the man, Rory Sheriff. How are you, Rory?
I'm good, man. How about yourself?
Good. Glad to have you on here. You got a pretty interesting story, a pretty interesting background, and pretty happy to get you on the Ethics Experts. So let's just jump in. Give us your elevator pitch, or tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of what it is you do and what impact you make on the world.
Well, I am the founding artistic director for a theater company that highlights the African-American experience on stage. We produce Broadway shows, Broadway shows here in Charlotte. I'm also a playwright and a screenwriter and a wannabe actor slash comedian and a former...
My kind of guy.
Yeah. So I'm a former radio personality as well. So it's kind of cool being on this side of the microphone.
Yeah. So what kind of, when you were a little kid, you know, dreaming of what you're going to be when you grow up, how different is what you're living now from that picture?
Oh man, it changed so much. I was a guy that really loved military shows like The Big Red One and Taps.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Taps really played a big part of my life and my decision making moving forward. I'm also a former combat Army veteran. So I served in Desert Storm, Desert Shield. So, Taps played a big role in that. I thought that was like so cool. And shows like the Green Beret. So,
yeah,
I did chase that dream. How about that? I went into the Army and was an airborne ranger as well. So
what did you? Wow. Airborne ranger. That's kind of cool. What was that experience like? How different was that from what you kind of saw on Taps or these other shows, you know?
You know, it was everything that I expected. I was prepared. You know, the Taps prepared me.
Imagine that.
You know, like a movie really prepares you for real life stuff. Imagine that. But yeah, it prepared me. And I was a kid, man. I was in my teens and I was like, I want to be in the military. So, I did that. And once I got that military experience and that discipline, life started, you know, working for me. Doors started opening and dreams started happening. I started thinking that I didn't want to play Taps so much anymore. My personality was growing and, you know, I wanted to be funny and I was a writer. So I wanted to write. I wanted to do other things than play soldier. So I wanted to see what else was out there to play soldier. I did enough defending the country.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to, at the time, believe it or not, like sit behind a desk or produce comedy shows. When I got out, I wanted to, I started wanting to be like Russell Simmons with Def Comedy Jam. And I actually did start a company. It was called Ebony Flavor. So it was kind of like Def Comedy Jam, but a low budget, you know, because my talent, you know, I was paying my talent like $50.
Yeah.
So. But you know, I did have some really cool guys. I grew up in the Philadelphia area. Kevin Hart came through there.
Mm-hmm.
Tracy Morgan was expensive at the time. He wanted $200.
Jeez. Who does he think he is, man?
Who does he think he is? You know, I had some really cool names like JB Smoove. It was cool, man. So growing up and post Army prepared me for you know, life. You know, I hear a lot of kids say, yeah, my dad was in the military and he was a military guy and this is why I am. So I kind of implement that in, you know, as being a father to my boys and my daughter.
Yeah. How old are your kids?
I'm a drill sergeant.
Yeah, well, you got to be a little bit of a drill sergeant. You got that experience there. Yeah. How old are your kids?
So believe it or not, my oldest is 31.
Wow.
28. 22 and 19.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, you're kind of on the other side of the thing. Mine are all under, you know, 9. So I'll have to have you back on to get some more wisdom out of you.
Those are the fun days, man. Those are the fun days.
Is that right? Huh.
Yeah, they go fast. They go fast.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you have to kind of learn to find the magic in it because it seems like such a crazy time, you know? But everybody you talk to says, like, oh, that was the happiest time of my life. So it's interesting. Yeah. So you get out of the Army. You have this desire to kind of get into the performance space at some level, whether that's on the production side or on the writing side. What do you think that was rooted in? And when did it become clear to you that, man, I'm really this kind of a person in spite of these other experiences?
So in junior high school, I'm just now realizing where that came from now. So in junior high school, I found myself really fascinated with Shakespeare and English and history and civics and civil history. Yeah. I really was fascinated, and I did really well in those classes, and it just carried on in high school. I can write some really good papers fast under pressure, and I would get A's across the board. I like to tell people I'm a thug that had good grades, so if that makes sense.
Yeah, a well-rounded thug, I like it. Yeah.
So it came, you know, from some really good teachers that really took their time to invest in me, you know, as far as learning and really pulling me aside and not allowing me to be a statistic, and just, you know, pushing me and, you know, not afraid to call home and tell my parents that, look, this guy is acting up and he's a good kid and we want to see him. And plus, also, I have a martial arts background.
Oh, cool.
So at 9, I started with karate. At the age of 9 years old, jiu-jitsu and aikido.
Wow.
So I'm also a fourth degree
black belt. The way of harmony, huh?
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah.
How about that?
So aikido's a great martial art. That's a great one.
It really is. So, you know, just traveling the country, competing in karate tournaments, you know, it was broadening my horizon and my experiences with people. And, you know, and I didn't know. So these are all things that makes up Rory. So
you get out of the Army, you want to start pursuing this this dream. You start a little comedy show. You start writing. When did it all kind of come together? And when did you hit that certain gate where you were like, all right, this is the spot for me. I'm going to go kind of pedal to the metal.
So my comedy show. Company, it was Ebony Flavor Entertainment. It was doing good. We were selling out shows and everything, but I did not at the time. I did not have the financial discipline at the time.
Yeah.
So I would deal with thousands and tens of thousands of dollars in my 20s, and Puffy was not a good role model for a guy like me. So when I'm seeing, you know, I'm a young single guy, man, in my 20s, making a lot of money, traveling places, I just was not saving my money. I was spending my money every show.
Yeah.
Just trying to impress people. So eventually that didn't hold up, you know, and I had to fold with the company because there was a time that I couldn't pay people. I couldn't hire people.
Right.
So I had to fold and I had got a job. And I wasn't liking it, but I knew I had to work. I knew I had to make money. So I eventually used my degree to get into radio. And I landed a radio gig, a part-time radio gig first, at doing Spanish radio.
Ah.
There's a story behind that. I'm doing Spanish radio, but I didn't want to do Spanish radio, but I knew I wanted to be on the radio. So this was my step in the door. I got in there, and then I landed a job on the largest radio station in Philadelphia, which at the time was called Power 99, still is. I was part-time working full-time hours, and I came down here in Charlotte. I transferred because I wanted to work full-time on the radio. Mm-hmm. So I transferred to a station called Hot 92.7. So at that point, I wanted to do radio, and radio was in my blood. I didn't want to do anything because you were famous on radio, but there's a saying in radio that it's the only career that you can be famous and broke at the same time. So, you know, I was getting famous, but I was still struggling to pay my bills. So So, you know, I just started thinking things through and I started writing. So I penned a couple novels and the novels were starting to pick up and, you know, selling. So I was making more money, having another line of revenue coming in. And it was the opportunity for that line of revenue to sustain my lifestyle was there. So I left the radio. After being in radio for 16 years,
wow.
I left it on my own to chase a career in writing. Wrote a script. I penned four books, four novels, and then I wrote a script. And I had an agent that got me a pitch in L.A.
Yeah,
pitched this thing. They are so rude.
Are they? What happened? What happened with the pitch?
You got to have thick skin. I worked on this pitch for like 2 months.
Yeah.
You have to have thick skin because they will talk about you in your face like you're not there.
Really?
It wasn't bad like this guy is ugly or he stinks or his work sucks. It was like, you know, we're not going to invest in this project. It's too much. He has too much going on. He has too much in this script going on and we don't know this guy, you know, we're not going to invest. But I'm hearing that it's a good script and I'm hearing just because you don't know me, you're not going to invest in it.
Right.
So that's what I heard. So, you know, in my desperation, I was like, well, what are you guys looking for? And they were looking for a rom-com. And I was like, something told me to take this other script, which I thought was garbage and trash. I took it, and they gave me 2 minutes to pitch it. I pitched it, and they bought it.
Get out of here.
But for
imagine, yeah, imagine if you wouldn't have brought it. Imagine if you didn't have that inkling. That's crazy.
Yeah. They bought it for a fraction of what I was looking for the original script. But
you sold
like
the script. But that's still good to sell a script. I mean, there's a lot of guys who never sell anything.
Exactly. So came back to Charlotte. One of the assistant producers came out and was like, hey, I really love this. And she gave me some advice to either put it on stage or to turn it into a cartoon. Thus, BNS Productions was born then. And I put my work on the stage. Gathered some friends and family to do a reading in front of an audience. They loved it. And we started producing a piece called Be a Lion. Be a Lion today, after 8 years later, Be a Lion is our biggest selling musical. It sells out, and it's the sequel or continuation, legally, I have to say that, of The Wiz. So we have 18 original songs in that piece, and it does really well. So
wow. And so was that the, did you like stageify that script that they ended up not wanting to do? Is that kind of how it worked?
Yes, I did.
Super interesting.
That's what I did. So I workshopped it, basically worked it, and put it on stage. And there's a whole long story behind that experience in itself. We worked it to a point that it's successful and it's a family-oriented play. Originally, it wasn't family-oriented because we had like some sexual innuendos in there.
Tone it down there, fella.
You know, so when you get kids, you know, families and kids are walking out of the play, you know, you got to adjust. So.
I'd love to see an early draft at some point. That's funny.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, what's kind of interesting is, like, you had something there, right? Like, there was something in that script that people saw and were like, this is it. There's something here. Yeah. You take it out there, and in the format that you were talking about, it wasn't right at that time for those investors, whatever. But there was something there enough for you to translate that into a stage play. And look, here we are years later. It's still running, still a moneymaker. So that takes a certain dynamism and it takes a certain fluidity in order to like be able to like recraft something that's already essentially built. Because like if you're going to pitch something in LA, this is like you've spent a lot of time on this thing. You've probably had multiple iterations, many drafts of this thing. And you, at some point you feel like, okay, this is kind of baked full enough to go and kind of serve it. To have to like deconstruct that cake and rebake it is a hard thing that a lot of folks aren't willing to do. Where does that fluidity come from in you?
It comes from my martial arts background and my military background.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear a voice every time that I want to give up. I hear this voice of a family member the day I was leaving for the military. And you have people, well, today they call them haters, but you have people who are dream killers and this family member said, I was leaving on a Thursday, right? And he said to me, I'll see you Tuesday.
Wow.
Like, I was going to get kicked out of the military, and they were going to send me back on Tuesday.
See you next Tuesday, well, he says. Wow.
Yeah, see you next Tuesday. And every time I wanted to quit, I think about that voice, that person. And I finally told that person that, you're the reason why I push on what you said. And he said, well, you're welcome.
Of course he said that. What else would he have said?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, I was a kid, man, and you had no belief and no faith in me, and I looked up to that person at the time. So I proved him wrong. So
yeah.
My stubbornness, you know, that just to prove somebody wrong, that no, and it benefits me too. So
yeah, so. That chip on your shoulder, or the chips on our shoulder, can really be superpowers if you don't let them jade you and really, I don't know, denigrate you. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes that chip on the shoulder can get toxic, but when you use it for positive, like you're trying to prove the world wrong, I can resonate with that for sure. So, you know, BNS, what does that stand for? That's your production company.
BNS stands for Brand New Sheriff.
Cool.
New Sheriff Production.
Very cool.
I took it from Eddie Murphy's 48 Hours.
Yeah,
there's a new sheriff in town.
Yeah, I love it. And so do you feel like you've kind of found your groove? You kind of went this comedy route. You went the radio route. You know, I'm not saying that you're precluded from doing screenplays and books and so forth, but your production company is primarily focused on stage plays. What is it about that realm that you really like so much?
Initially, on the surface, I want to say it's safe, but it's not.
It's like the least safe of all of them.
Yeah. But I feel safe in that realm. I feel safe in that circle, like making this thing happen. And it feels good that I can create a space for African-American actors, African-American techs, writers, crew. Typically, when African-American folks in theater, you know, it's sad to say that their opportunity to shine happens. The most opportunity to shine happens in February, Black History Month.
Oh, right.
A lot of the theater companies, they rush to do a Black show because they want to support Black History Month. They think it's right, but technically it's not. And I told them that personally. I told them that on in the media when I did interviews. You can do that for Black History Month, but do it throughout the year as well.
Yeah.
Not this. What makes it seem like you're patronizing Black people, or it seems a bit racist as well if you're only doing it in February.
Yeah.
Show love. Show love to people who come and buy tickets and they want to see more of these stories told. You can do it throughout the year. And most of the theater companies, they heard that. So I have a platform and one of the loudest voices here in Charlotte when it comes to theater and representing African Americans. So that's one of the things that I put out throughout the community and throughout the country as well, because they're starting here. There's even more an African American initiative through theater in North Carolina. So I had a conference 2 weeks ago. So I hear that, and I even made it a point to bring up. I said, this is all great talk, but it's only talk right now.
Yeah.
Let's see these things in work, in motion, and then we can have the conversation when we come back. What are we doing wrong and what are we doing right? But we have to put this conversation in motion. It sounds all good on paper, and we as African Americans, we hear this all the time. We hear the great talk, but we don't see the great work in action.
Yeah, and what does that feel like? I mean, how does that feel?
It feels like crap. And I don't know if we can cuss on this thing, but it feels
this
like...
This is a PG-13, so you get one F-bomb per episode.
Okay, all right, cool. I'll reserve the F-bomb.
Okay.
But it really feels like crap when you do it, but we're so used to it.
Yeah.
Because it's always been talked, we're so used to it. That's why... companies like BNS Productions is doing so well, because we're representing that work We're not just talk. We're not words. Like, right. We're fine and creative in spaces. And there's not enough companies in Charlotte like BNS Productions. I don't think there can ever be enough companies. But we need to form more theater companies, and more theater, and the theater companies that exist need to have more representation of African American theater.
There's this whole concept of greenwashing, right? And this kind of came out of kind of particularly the 90s, when there were all these sort of environmental pushes from these big energy companies. And they would just say a lot of things that sounded really good with respect to environmentalism. But then when you kind of looked underneath the hood, you saw that it was all just a bunch of BS, you know? And I fear we've traversed across this, or greenwashing has sort of traversed across and is showing its face in things like Black History Month and so forth, where, hey, you know, we're changing our logo for the month. And then, you know, the worst is when it's a leap year and they have their algorithms ready to change back on, you know, the day after the 28th, and it's technically still Black History Month, but their logos go back. You know, that in itself is like proof of this thing that we're talking about. So if you put on sort of both sides of the spectrum, one side is a company that's just, for lack of a better term, like greenwashing African-American history or the African-American experience by paying it a little bit of lip service once a year. And then you got a company like BNS Productions on the other side of the spectrum. What is it that you think you are, like what hunger are you satiating or what thirst are you quenching in the broader marketplace with that's rooted in this authenticity that you bring to the table?
Just telling, just being honest with our stories,
putting
it on the table and just going for it, sharing our stories. And, you know, there's no, I've tried to avoid a lot of the stereotypical, Hollywood stories, like, you know, having the African-American thief, crook, thug,
we can't
be professionals. We don't have, you know, August Wilson is a genius. He takes the everyday Black man and really, really highlights him and his experience, and he does it so well. Tell real stories, and not the stories that we've been pushed to understand that Black people are like. You know, granted, there may be a grain of truth in some of those stories, but, you know, we're so complex. We're not a monolithic type of people.
Right.
We're so complex, and our stories are complex. And my job and my calling is to bring forth those complex stories and to highlight them and to teach folks who don't know that, oh, man, wow, African-Americans are geniuses and they are family people and they do want the same thing as our white counterparts.
Right.
They do want great families and they do want education and they are hardworking. They're not lazy. You know, they are some of the hardworking folks in the country,
right,
in the world, you know. So these are the stories and these are the truths. And it's just not Martin Luther King. It's just not Rosa Parks. You know, we have all of those people in our community. In every community, we have them living and thriving, and they're just not preachers and pastors. We have everyday community leaders. So that's my goal. That's my calling, and that's what I'm doing is just highlighting our stories.
Do you feel like, you know, I'm sure we have a long way to go, but do you feel like we're starting to gain some traction in terms of turning some of those light bulbs on, or do you feel like, man, we're still in like the freaking first inning of this thing?
It feels that way, and then when you turn on the news,
yeah, I know,
we're reminded, you know, of where we are when you turn on the TV and you see things like January 6th, or you see the Proud Boys marching around, or when I see all these Confederate flags and stuff. Big flags and American flags and all these things just driving past me. I'm reminded of my ancestors. I'm reminded of the trauma that my ancestors went through. I'm reminded of the hangings and things that my ancestors went through and the systematic racism that's going on today. And so it feels good. But I don't think we're making that much of a leap because civil rights movement did the same thing that we're doing today.
So yeah.
I don't know. I can't answer that and say, yeah, but I will say there's moments that it feels good. But just like something that feels good, but it is temporary. Especially when I see these images, you know, yeah. driving past me or on the news. So we got a lot of work to do. Do I think that we have, are we forming more allies? Yep, absolutely. And do I believe that more white people are getting it and understanding? Yeah, I do. I do, but it's not enough. Mm-hmm. And I think white people need to check white people. I don't believe that me as a black man can check and get through to a racist white guy. Mm-hmm. Because I'm the guy he doesn't like. I'm the image he doesn't like. He's not going to hear me.
Right.
But if they're hearing their own kind, like, dude, you know, you're really being a jerk. You know, like, why are you racist? And so this is, racism is deeply rooted into people.
Yeah.
So it's going to take someone white to like, yo, man, you're an asshole, basically.
Yeah.
And I understand where it comes from, but who better to check white people than white people?
Yeah, well, it can't be just one. It can't be on one person to do it, to drive
right.
a change, to your point. But the interesting part,
right.
and this is probably true throughout the world, but like some of the most racist people I've ever met, like, don't know any black people. Never been around them, never grew up with them, any of that kind of stuff. So it's kind of an interesting thing, because if that's where the root of this racism is, obviously there's historical things and, you know, things structurally and so forth. But if that's where the root of it is, to your point, that last mile to hit that tipping point where we really start seeing some traction and really start seeing some change is kind of in the hands of people that are around those kinds of folks. And if those are predominantly white people, to your point, then it's time for those people to step up and speak some truth into those people's lives. You know, what I'm kind of struck with as you were kind of describing this is, you know, I'm not gassing you up, but it's kind of a noble pursuit what you're doing. And it's perhaps in the most effective medium that there is, which is story. You know, putting a bunch of stats on the screen for somebody who has a misconception about black people is probably not going to resonate as deeply as seeing an emotional story of what someone is going through. There's so many of those emotional notes, because again, if you tear our skin off, we all look the same. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Those same feelings, those same desires that we have, the love of your child, the feeling of achievement when you do something nice for someone, all that stuff transcends race. Obviously it transcends country and all those kinds of things. And sometimes it just takes kind of seeing a glimpse into, to your point, somebody else's experience or how they're actually wired or the struggles that they're going through to really relate. Because irrespective of skin color, irrespective of socioeconomic status, I always say no one gets to their deathbed and is like, that was easy. Like, life is hard for everybody, regardless of your lot in life and your station. And if we can't relate on our humanity, then what are we going to relate on? That we both
exactly.
like the same sports team? I mean, how artificial and surface level is that? You know, we're fighting the same fight at some level. We have the same desires at some level. And knocking down some of these differences is, you know, appropriate to kind of move forward. But that play with story and that opportunity to sort of show that black experience to folks that maybe haven't been exposed to it is a really powerful leverage point. When you talk about the black experience, you know, you kind of touched on it a little bit, but maybe we can dive into, you know, one of your favorite plays that you've penned or something, and talk a little bit about what aspects of the experience you're trying to capture. And I'm asking this in the sense of last year I did this book challenge and I tried to read 100 books in the year. And it was great because it gave me an opportunity to like dive deep on some topics that I wasn't really that educated about. And I got to read some classics. And I read The Souls of Black Folks by W.E.B. Du Bois. And it was such an eye-opener for me. Like, the way he articulated it at a time when, you know, it was kind of historical, but then I'm reading it and I'm like, this could have been freaking written probably like 5 or 10 years ago or something. But that was like such an eye-opener for me, because he has, I mean, I'm sure you read this guy. He has such a way with words to really paint this picture and really get down to what I thought was kind of the crux of, you know, to try to understand kind of the crux of this duality that I think a lot of black people feel and experience, where I'm part of this country, but I'm kind of not. And I'm in this thing, but I'm kind of an outsider. And That's a super, you know, when you're talking about like trauma of ancestors that many of us are still living through now, to the extent that those things continue to permeate our lives, the trends of the past are going to perpetuate. So when we're talking about the Black experience, when we're talking about some of these dynamics that you're trying to convey on the stage, what are you trying to get at, and how do you end up kind of articulating that in this forum?
One of my pieces that I wrote, I wrote a piece called Boys to Baghdad. And Boys to Baghdad is loosely my experience in the military, the time that the week before I left and when I got out. But it really keys on my family prior, like at 18, 19 years old. Mm-hmm. So it highlights family. I'm really, really big on family. My family, big on family. So it highlights, and the funny, because you always have the character, the comedy release. So I got a character named Uncle Lenny. Uncle Lenny is blind. He's a little older. He's blind. He loves hip hop. I don't know if I can say this, but he has a porn addiction. In the late 80s, he's blind. Imagine that. So that's my comedy release.
Okay.
And he's just made up of, like, my granddad was, like, blind and a couple of my uncles. So he's a comedy release. But I would say just the funny and stuff about family. But here's something that you touched on about white people who's never been around Black people. I have a friend. I have a brother at arms. His name was Poe. His last name was Poe. Poe is from South Dakota. He's never been around white people. And this is a true story. He did his research. And I mean, he's never been around Black people. He did his research before he came to the Army about Black people. His research was the movie Do the Right Thing.
Really dialed that in there. Good job there, Poe.
Thank you. Yeah. So Poe has no experience. His only experience, his only knowledge about Black people is Do the Right Thing. Spike Lee's
amazing.
Movie, Do the Right Thing.
Amazing.
So, needless to say, Poe was getting a lot of blanket parties, and he was taking a lot of L's, man. But the type of person I am, you know, I had to get to know this guy, you know, and I wanted to know him. And he seemed like he was a cool guy. He just didn't know any better. And he just kept saying all the racist things, like, you people. He never said the N-word because, you know, that would have been a rap for him. But he would say, like, you people and all this kind of stuff. But Poe surprised. We went to war with him. And, you know, going to war with somebody, you know, we got each other's back.
Totally.
It changes everything. When you're being fired at, it changes. Racism is so minimal.
Right. It's like the last thing you're worried about. Right.
It's the last thing. I'm not like, oh, is this white guy going to save my back? I'm yelling like, Poe, to your 3 o'clock. And he's yelling, Sheriff, to your 9. You know, he's like, you got my 6, I got your 12 and stuff like that. Yeah, and we're in survival mode. So I share that story with Boys of Baghdad and how Poe was, you know, nobody really liked him at all. But he ended up being my friend. Poe was actually shot. He never died, but in Boys of Baghdad, he dies. But he was wounded really bad. He was shot really bad. And I put a tourniquet on him and you know, kind of really did save his life. Mm-hmm. But he never died. And people keep on asking me, did Poe die? You know, in real life, it's a real sad moment. No, he didn't die. But he's really gone mentally right now. So the PTSD and stuff.
Oh,
so
man.
He doesn't even recognize me.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, what is that like? What's that
yeah,
like, seeing this guy that you saved his life and he doesn't even recognize you? That's crazy.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. It's not a good feeling.
Yeah.
I got a couple, we call them battle buddies, or battles, a couple battle buddies that, you know, are gone.
Yeah.
Really mentally, some of it is funny. But you know, I got people that would call me on FaceTime from the VA hospital with no shirt on. I was like, man, first of all, you might want to put your shirt on, man.
Yeah, first
I'm
off,
not going to be talking to you.
Right. Looks like you're in the bath there, pal.
Damn. You know, it's not fun. I can laugh because I know these guys. You know,
yeah.
We were kids. But one guy, he hitchhiked or found his way from Chicago to D.C., because he had, and he lives in D.C. now because he was chasing Obama. Oh, man. So I can go into detail, but yeah, man, Boys of Baghdad. Let's go back to Boys of Baghdad. This is one of those stories, man. It's like, you know, a Boys to Men type of, you know, type of story, you know, and it's one of my most impactful shows, pieces that I've written. So it covers everything: family, racism, brotherhood, and life altogether. Good thing is that when I did it a couple years ago, a lot of the fellas that I served with in the store came to see the show, which was a good treat for the audience. So yeah.
So I'd love to switch gears a little bit and talk about what lessons you've learned and what lessons you've tried to implement when, hey, okay, my script's ready. I'm going to sort of build out this play. I'm going to use a bunch of wrong terms because I clearly have no idea what I'm talking about, so bear with me. But I'm going to find a bunch of actors. I mean, do you direct them? Do you find a director? What role do you play in the sort of actual production? And so in that production, what I'd like to kind of get at is, what culture lessons did you learn from your time in the Army? Or what kind of best practices do you have when you get this new group of people that are kind of unified around a pretty clearly defined goal of, like, we want to have a great production of this play. We have a script here. But you have to get all these different personalities and egos to, like, mesh together and pursue this goal. What kind of exercises do you do, or what kind of lessons do you learn as you kind of kick off that new production to get these folks to mesh?
Let me have this caveat. First, at the time, I just wanted to write. I'm a writer. That's all I wanted to do. But falling into this, you know, I've been into theater. I've acted before. I even acted in theater and worked some theater in Germany when I was over there in the Army. So with that out the way, I still didn't know anything of what I was doing. I just knew that I needed to get a couple people that wanted to think they can act or something. And I just reached out a couple people, some mostly friends and family, mostly people that I knew, say, hey, we're going to read the script. And then some of those folks stood around because I didn't know much about casting. You know, so I had to be a casting director. I had to be a director. I had to be a producer. And sometimes I had to be an actor.
Yeah.
So I had to do all these things. And what it was doing is preparing me for today. I had to recognize that, you know, although I love this person as a friend, as a family member, they are not good for this vision.
Yeah.
And I had to learn how to tell her that. I had to learn how to move on with people without people and letting people go and stuff like that.
That's hard to do.
On this journey. So it was really hard. It was really tough, but it was a great experience. And it prepared me for where I am now. So as you go on and then you take a lot of losses financially, investing your own money and believing in yourself like this, people are going to see that you believe in them, and they're going to see that, you know, you mean well for their career, you know, as far as acting, and you're trying to put them in a great position. At the same time, your accounts are in the red, and you're borrowing money trying to keep this company and this crazy dream afloat, of performing and someday selling out shows, or just, you know, I just want, at one point, I just needed 30 people per show. that was my goal, 30 people per show in 180 seat theater. So now, you know, putting in that hard work and hiring the right people and talking to, networking with great directors and realizing that, you know, I'm not that good of a director at the time. Let me hire some really good people, and let me do other shows like August Wilson's and Lynn Nottage and really well-known writers and really well-known shows. And let me put butts in these seats and do these other shows. People will come see these other shows with its networking and developing a great actors pool.
Gotcha.
So people started coming to see these shows. And then I can pitch, you know, in the audience because I have a captive audience.
Right.
Then I can pitch about my shows that I've written. And then I can put in the program, well, here's another original piece that we've written and get the word out. And that's basically what I did with BNS Production. That's how we basically grew.
That's pretty smart. Pretty smart angle, right? You can kind of leverage some of these works that maybe are a little bit more well-known. People can come in, get a little taste of the type of shows you put on, hear about some other ones that are the original works, and boom, you got a little flywheel running.
Yeah, and, I was able to, we started the company, it's a 501c3, a nonprofit, and so we were able to receive donations and able to apply for grants and stuff, and we started getting some grants, and getting, you know, folks that donate to theater starting to believe in us and giving us a chance, basically.
I get so inspired hearing stories like this, man, just to pause you. Like, I get so inspired hearing stories where, you know, you have this idea and you're just so tenacious. You keep hitting impediments, but you figure out a way over, around, under, and through to keep this dream alive. That kind of industrious ingenuity is the heart of whatever American dream we're all running after, you know? Not stopping, keep continuing to move forward, figuring out a way to make it happen. It's super inspiring. And, you know, we always talk about how, you know, your life takes all these twists and turns and you're like, what the hell is happening here? But then you arrive at some point where you look in the rear view and you're like, ah, all those stumbles made sense. All those things kind of put me, you know, where I'm at. And, you know, as I've gotten older, I feel like I'm starting to get more comfortable with that dynamic that, like, okay, if something doesn't go right, like, take a breath. This is going to be a stepping stone for something else in the future. You know, when we're younger, it's easy to get caught up in a failure or, you know, a setback that you kind of deem a failure and, you know, beat yourself up. I'm sure you've had a lot of those, like, little mini J curves as you've gotten this thing going and ascended toward this 501c3. So, you know.
Yeah, and when that type of tenacity, I guess, it started when, back to martial arts, I really wanted my black belt so bad.
Yeah.
So I worked my butt off to get this black belt, and I wanted it before I graduated high school. And I did. So you put in all that training, and you do that, and you get a taste of hard work and accomplishment. That becomes addictive.
Totally.
And then when you're in the military, then, you know, you really want to go airborne and the training is so hard, but you know, after that 21st day, then you're jumping, you're making all those jumps, you're going to graduate and you get that patch on your I guess at the time it was BDUs on your uniform. And you walk around with that chip that we talked about.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I got this. I'm a little badass. I'm more badass than the average person.
Right.
Then when you get that airborne patch on your sleeve and when you go to Desert Storm. So all these things play a role in my tenacity and my discipline.
Yeah.
And just staying the trail. That plays a role in. Now at my age, I'm like looking at all these things like, yep, I can do that. That's a piece of cake. I've been through hell. This is nothing.
Right.
I've been through hell and back. We'll get through this. I know that tomorrow's coming. The sun is just going around. And it's going to come up tomorrow.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. And just having that faith to say, okay, it's a little bit of faith in yourself to know you can overcome because you've overcome something bigger. It's the long-term view to know that, like, my life is not going to end because this little thing didn't work out. It really can start to feed into that tenacity. I'd love to, you know, we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier and then we went a different direction, but I'd love to talk a little bit about, like, and again, this is me as an outsider, so, you know, bear with me here, but, like, the ethics of entertainment, particularly, like, African-American entertainment, we talked about it a little bit. You know, you have groups like yours who seem to have, like, a purity of purpose and a purpose beyond the particular, you know, show that we're talking about. It's a broader story that you're trying to tell, right? And this purity of purpose drives you to be really authentic with the scripts you put out and the teams of people that end up acting these plays out. All these things are kind of part and parcel with what you're trying to deliver. And then you have this sort of monolith on the Hollywood side that seems to continue to spit out the same thing over and over again. And, you know, this is not unique, I don't think, to the African-American, you know, entertainment. Or, I mean, we see the same thing in all these other genres. But what do you think is rooted in that? Why does that continue to perpetuate? And what can we do to get more people, like more of your heart into this broader story?
I think it continues because it's deeply rooted. It started out with racism, that it initially did. That, you know, they weren't given African Americans roles, leading roles. You know, African Americans started out with maids, maids and butlers in the help, or slaves, or prisoners, and stuff like that. So it's deeply rooted into the psyche of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And then, so when they do give a chance to African Americans to lead, it's only a selective few. Mm-hmm. So there's more Denzels out there. There's more Will Smiths located right here in Charlotte. There's talent just as good as those guys. But, you know, I guess Hollywood only sees fit to only give it to, you know, just a selective few.
Yeah, one at a time or something.
One at a time.
It's bizarre.
Yep. Which is crazy. Yep. So, you know, thank God for things like outlets such as, you know, YouTubes and social medias and, you know, folks are, you know, producing their own work independently. But is it good as Hollywood? No, it's not good as Hollywood. They have the lock. They have that on lock. And basically, to Hollywood, if it's not broke, they're not going to try to fix it. Mm-hmm. And our job is to highlight the fact that the system is broken. And over the last couple of years, they have been. So, you know, with the hashtag Oscars are so white. So we're making strides there, I think. I hope, as far as Hollywood and as far as theater. The good thing as far as theater, all of Broadway, every last Broadway show this coming season is written by African-American or directed by African-American.
Wow.
Every last one of them, every last theater, which is great. So, you know, I can appreciate that. That feels really good. And that's in September, you know. So,
yeah, that's pretty exciting. What do you think that is?
Yeah,
it's just time. It's just like
it's time. It's time. I think Broadway is recognizing, like, hey, you know what? We are doing the same thing as we have done, the same thing as Hollywood has done.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're seeing all of this talent. All through Broadway, all through off-Broadway, and then there's a coalition of our co-talent of our white actors. They're standing by us,
yeah,
and standing next to us, and like, hey, this is BS. We think this is BS, and there are some really great African American stories. There's some really great African American talent here, and they need to be told. So yeah. And that couldn't be done with just African Americans alone, because we've been saying that for years. That couldn't be done without our white allies just stepping up, and also our gay allies. They're like, hey, this is wrong. So, you know, there's a movement.
Yeah, and so, it seems to be gaining a little bit of momentum, which is great.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Where can people find out more about you, Rory? Where can they find some of your plays? Where can they get in touch with you to learn more about the work that you're doing?
I'm all on social media, all the major ones. Brand New Sheriff, just as it is, Brand New Sheriff. And then there's the website, brandnewsheriff.com. Social media, I'm really active social media. On it. As the kids say, I'm on the gram. I'm on the book.
Very good.
And I tweet every now and then, so yeah.
All right, cool. Well, we'll put We'll put all your social media in the show notes. It's been really fun having you on, Rory. Any parting words, any words of advice that you would give the younger version of yourself before we wrap up?
The younger version of me is like, you're doing good, man. Just
keep
just
doing
keep
it.
Keep going. Yeah, just doing you, basically. I have no regrets. I can't even think of the quote from, there's a play called Passing Strange. Like, just to paraphrase it, like, the person I am now, the person I am today was because of the decisions that a teenager made.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. Those seeds we plant turn into trees down the road in our life, you know?
Absolutely.
Well, this has been a great conversation, man. I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate you spending so much of your morning with us and sharing some of your experience. I love your work. I love the impact that you're making, and I can't wait to check out one of your shows hopefully this fall.
Thank you. I have a show opening up next week.
Boom.
Check us out.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. We'll put that in the show notes, too. All right.
All right.
Until next time.
Thanks, man.